My guest today, Peter K. Enns, is an associate professor in the Department of Government and executive director of the Roper Center of Public Opinion Research at Cornell University. And he is a team leader at the Institute for Social Science, theme project on the causes, consequences, and future of mass incarceration in the United States, and former faculty director of Cornell's Prison Education Program. His research focuses on public opinion, representation, mass incarceration, and inequality. He also teaches courses on quantitative research methods. His recent book, Incarceration Nation, published by Cambridge University Press, explains why the public became more punitive in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and how this increasing punitiveness led to the rise of mass incarceration in the United States, which is what we're going to talk about with him today. Welcome to Takes on the World, Peter Enns.
Jeff, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
It seems that your book is very appropriate for these times. During the campaign, not only did Bernie Sanders bring this up, but the Republicans seemed to be coming on board with Paul Ryan and one of their major funders, the Koch brothers, even talking about the necessity of changing our incarceration methods. Do you see a positive trend here?
Yes, I do. And you're absolutely right that this is a very important political and social issue right now. And what's so interesting about both the Democrats and even prominent Republicans, as you mentioned, beginning to call for criminal justice reform, the public's been moving in a less punitive direction. The high point of the public's punitiveness was actually the mid-1990s. So this, I take this as further evidence of the political system following public opinion on this issue.
Do you think, given our two new candidates, the presumptive candidates for president, Hillary Clinton, whose husband, Bill, presided over, had legislation passed which resulted or led to an increase in mass incarceration. And I don't know if what Trump has expressed opinions on this, but do you think this is going to be part of the conversation, the debates, or will you just have them going back and forth in each other's records and trading insults?
It's certainly in this campaign season and with this election, making any type of predictions is certainly a difficult task. I do think we'll see continued attention to this issue. The cost of maintaining the world's highest incarceration rate, it is a budgetary issue that affects state governments, the federal government, but also the human and the social costs. And again, the public has been paying more attention to this and moving in a more tolerant direction. So whether that will continue is hard to know, but it does seem to me that this will be an important issue during the campaign. Whether it's the most important, hard to say, and what other issues or what other approaches occur, anything can happen, I think, at this point. But this is a very critical issue, and I don't think our politicians, especially in the presidential campaign, will ignore it.
One interesting thing is you have a tremendous amount of research and data in this book. It's this slim volume, but there's so much in it. You note that between the late 1960s and the early 2000s, the incarceration rate in the United States increased by some 400%. And most experts have concluded that our political leaders fuel that rise through rhetoric and policy. What explanation did your research find more likely?
It turns out, based on my research, that it's actually the opposite of the standard story. And you're right, Jeff, that typically researchers, historians, pundits in the media have drawn attention to political leaders as driving the changes. And of course, it has been political and policy changes that led to the rise of mass incarceration. How we treat criminals, how we sentence them, these are policy choices. How much we spend, these are choices, political choices that have been made that have led to the rise of the incarceration rate. But it wasn't certain political leaders like Barry Goldwater or Richard Nixon who were leading the way, leading the public. It turns out these political leaders were following the public, following a growing demand for being tough on crime within the public. And it also wasn't just conservative political leaders following public, but it was liberal politicians like President Lyndon Johnson also followed the public on this issue. So if anything, it was the public leading the way and politicians of both parties responding to changing public opinion.
It also would seem that the media and I would say AM talk radio particularly, because I used to occasionally hear Michael Savage, who would like to put everyone in prison, AM talk radio would seem to stir up among leading the media in scaring people into thinking the crime situation was actually worse than it was. How does the coverage of crime relate to the actual facts of criminal activity?
The media is very important to this process. You're right there. And what as the name implies, what media is doing is it's the bridge essentially between crime committed and public, because of course some individuals unfortunately experience crime or know people who have been the victims of crime, but most of the information the broader public has is what's coming to them from the news, whether it's AM radio or newspapers, TV, nightly news. And the news overreports violent crime and tends to report in a sensationalistic way, focusing on the details, the grimmest details of the crime, not offering a broader context of why crime rates change or what policies are the most effective to deter crime. That tends not to be what's covered. And so what happens is, and what happened in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and this all started in the 60s, the crime rate started going up, and media was covering crime more and more, following the rising crime rate. And so as the crime rate went up, the public was getting more and more information about crime, more reports of the crime rate rising, and more of these sensationalistic news stories of the most violent crimes. And so this is why the crime rate actually, when crime rate goes up, the public becomes more punitive because of the way media is covering crime. But the inverse is also true. Crime's been going down in this country since the late 1990s, both violent and property crime. And that's also why I mentioned the public's been moving in a less punitive direction. So when crime goes up, in the past 60 years, we've seen a more punitive public. And when crime goes down, we see a less punitive public.
Well, you know that there's a slogan in the media, if it bleeds, it leads. And so the preoccupation with details of a crime, even when very little is known, consumes so much of the media's interest and time. They put special reporters on the scene, and then they extrapolate into other areas. And, of course, this influences the public watching it. But in a sense, they're constantly also trying to find out, the media is trying to find out what the public wants to hear or read, and they're kind of leading the public on. And you have some comments about the way they take polls to judge how much attention people are paying or how much concern they are with the question of crime, what kind of a priority it is in their lives.
Yeah, and there's lots of poll data on this, and so there's kind of a couple approaches. So one approach is to try to gauge whether the public's becoming more or less punitive. And so to look at that, I look at hundreds of different polls. There's also, we can see evidence of us, even politicians doing this. And so one striking finding I came across was looking at internal memos in Richard Nixon's 1968 presidential campaign. And so these were memos from his top campaign advisors, his advisors during the campaign, that they were sending around, and these were reporting what they've been finding. They were conducting their own opinion polls, and they were also looking at the results from public opinion polls that were being released in the news at the time. And what they kept finding was the public was concerned with crime. And so this became a key feature of their campaign strategy based on the public opinion data. So they were in whatever state they seemed to poll in, they found a concern with crime. And so these memos talk about focusing on that and making that a key feature of the campaign. So absolutely, they were trying to judge what the public's concern was. They found crime was a concern, and that increasingly became a strategy of Nixon's 1968 presidential campaign.
You know, just off the cuff, one of the things that strikes me about American culture, society, and I've lived in elsewhere, I lived in Europe, is that Americans, through advertising and pressure and promotions, are encouraged to be frightened, you know, that their identity is going to be stolen. You listen to radio commercials, you think everyone's going to have their identity stolen. You have all kinds of, we're overinsured in terms of our property, everything, our life, our, except we have to pay for medical insurance where other countries get it for nothing. How much is this fear that's instilled in the American public affect their attitudes on crime in general?
That's a great question, and I think there's two components of that. So one is the fear factor, and you're absolutely right. This fear of a potential crime or fear of something bad happening. And then the second aspect is, how do we deal with that? And so one aspect in the crime realm could be, if the public is concerned with crime or fearful of crime, one solution would be, okay, what policies are going to reduce crime? So should we spend more on schools, more on job training, more on opportunities, more on mental health, more on helping those who have been incarcerated find jobs when they're released, right? So that would be one approach to the fear. Let's think of, what does the research say about which policies are going to address the fear, address the roots of crime? Another option is to be concerned or fearful of possible crime and think of, how can we punish this in the strictest way or most punitive way possible? And so I don't think concern with crime automatically has to translate into more punitive attitudes, but it's back to the way crime's covered, the way the if it bleeds, it leads slogan that you mentioned, and how politicians have responded to the public, that we get this punitive response. So a fear of crime, I don't think necessarily or automatically has to translate into a more punitive response, but that has been the history in this country. That's what has happened.
Of course, we had the classic Willie Horton case with George Bush the first, that image, and even Ronald Reagan invoked welfare queens as if promoting welfare or abusing welfare to be a bigger crime than it was or is. I mean, they've used that in order to get elected and to scare people into voting for them, and looking at their when they're walking down the street, looking at somebody who looks different from them, who's maybe black or Latino, in a different way, as if they're not legitimately on the same block with them, someone to be feared and also not to be connected to.
Yeah, and those points, Jeff, really resonate in a couple ways. One is when you mentioned race, and when we talk about the mass incarceration in the United States and the criminal justice system, we can't separate the conversation from race, right? Race is part of this. And one simple example, so as you mentioned, the great increase, the over 400% increase in the incarceration rate in the U.S., not only did the imprisonment rate go up, but who's incarcerated has changed. So in the 1950s, the majority of those imprisoned in the U.S. were white. Today, the majority of those imprisoned are racial minorities, African Americans and Latinos. So not only do we imprison much more, who we imprison has changed. So race is an important part of the story. And then the other point that I think is right on is about this, the Horton case. And if somebody's released from prison and commits another crime, that gets so much attention, and often deservedly so. But part of the reason is, if we spent money preventing crime, we never observe the crimes that were prevented. And so if we, instead of imprisoning so many people for so long, we prevented a lot of crimes, that would be a benefit to society, but we can't observe what didn't happen. But if we spend a ton of money and then one person is released and commits a heinous crime, that gets so much attention because that happens. We never observe what would have happened if we would have spent the money in a more cost-effective way. And whether almost all researchers today, whether it's economists, political scientists like myself, sociologists, historians, all are in agreement that the incarceration rate in the U.S. is much higher than the most cost-effective approach to reducing crime. That, in other words, if we had a different imprisonment rate where we paid more attention to the length of sentences and spent money in alternate ways, that it would be a cheaper way to actually reduce crime.
One of the things that's troubled me, and I happen to be a masochist, so I read the New York Times quite frequently, and I read the entire paper, and I see how often, how frequently you see stories about the release from prison of largely black, well, some Latino prisoners who have been in prison for maybe 20 to 30 years, some even on death row, who have been falsely convicted of murder, and the evidence against them was tampered with or withheld from their lawyers, that they were unjustly convicted. And actually, in Illinois, we have the Innocence Project, I think it's called, which started a number of years ago, going after a number of these cases, going where the people imprisoned had either very poor lawyers, court-appointed lawyers who didn't do their job, and so many of these prisoners have been freed after spending the better part of their lives inside prison. Do you think this has had some kind of an effect on making people think twice about the incarceration problem?
I do. This is such an important part of trying to understand our current criminal justice system. And so you mentioned the Innocence Project, and then the University of Michigan Law School is another organization that's paying increasing attention to this. And so the University of Michigan Law School, and they have a national registry of exonerations. And so since 1989, they've identified over 1,600 individuals who have been exonerated, who were imprisoned and then later found to be innocent. And perhaps more stunningly, 520 of those had been sentenced to death or to life in prison. And these are just the most extreme cases, right? I mean, the resources to review cases just aren't there. And so those who maybe were falsely imprisoned for 5 years or 10 years, their cases may not even be looked at because it's the longest sentences that tend to be looked at first. And this goes also back to our discussion on media, that if media presents a more nuanced story and covers these cases, well, then the public learns, hey, there's not only does it cost a lot to society in terms of budget allocations to imprison this many people, but if the imprisonment rate is this high, it has to be that there are people who were falsely convicted. And so when the public learns of imperfections in the judicial system, the public definitely moves in a more, less punitive direction, because the public wants a better system. They want if you don't learn about the errors in a system, you don't know that it should be corrected. And so as media reports on this isn't new, but as media reports on it, it definitely has an effect on the public's attitudes.
My guest is Peter K. Enns. We're talking about his book, Incarceration Nation, How the United States Became the Most Punitive Democracy in the World. Kind of punitive and democracy kind of seem like an oxymoron, but we'll go on. One of the problems is what happens to prisoners when they get out. And you may have seen the op-ed in the New York Times the other day by former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin on how to help former inmates thrive. And he talks about how so much money, thousands of dollars, are paid by taxpayers into keeping someone in prison. And then when they get out, they give them a couple $100 and send them on their way. And unless they have family support, some kind of structure, they're going to get back into prison. Maybe comment on that.
Yeah, this is such a challenge because we have this incredibly high incarceration rate, and most of those in prison today will be released. And so if there's no structure to help these individuals come back to society, find housing, find employment, the goal to have these individuals become productive members of society is such a challenge. And there are individuals who do that. I know individuals who have served prison time and now are employed, doing incredibly well. But these tend to be the exceptions. They're beating the odds. And not only do we spend so much as a society keeping individuals imprisoned and then offer almost nothing when they get out, if there's any debt, be it from a loan or child support, wallet from before going to prison, these accrue. So many individuals, huge proportions, are not only coming out with these disadvantages, but they also come out owing a huge amount of debt that's immediately due. And not paying back that debt could be a parole violation that leads to going back to prison. And so the odds are just so challenging.
Well, you speak also, there's a tendency of state legislatures, which are faced with big demands and decreasing budgets, to cut, let's say, legal services that are available to those who can't pay for them, and in the end, they end up paying more, but through incarceration. Perhaps you what does your study show about that?
Well, I think this relates to public opinion some. So as the public became more punitive and there's budget trade-offs, spending more on prisons and prosecutions instead of on legal defense or even services that might lead to less crime, those were the responses that that we got from politicians. And it's a tricky political environment, because the argument that if the public's moving in a more punitive direction, that, well, we need to spend money to save money in the long run, that's a harder case for a politician. If the politician can just campaign on saying, I'm following what the public wants, we're spending more on police, we're locking more people up, we're building more prisons, those feel like immediate responses, and oftentimes that's what the public's looking for. But again, I'm cautiously optimistic that as crime's gone down and the public's moved in a less punitive direction, that we might see more political debate, more policy discussions, and perhaps some policy decisions, political choices from our leaders that do take a slightly more long-term perspective in terms of thinking about the implications for the budget, the implications for the safety of society. Another example is states have had to reduce the amount they spend on other policy areas as the prison populations have grown to pay for that. So every state saw a rise in their incarceration rates and a higher percentage of their budget going to prison systems, every state also declined what percent of the budget went to higher education. So higher education was suffering to pay for more prisons. And not everybody realizes how the world's highest incarceration rate affects everybody, not just those who are in prison.
Well, I know in California, the prison guard union is one of the most powerful unions in the state, and politicians pay heed to it. And it's kind of like a brotherhood, a kind of a gang, the prison guards who look out for their own. Going back before, you mentioned the expression soft on crime is an accusation that many politicians have made against other politicians in order to gain the public's confidence. And I assume that's not going to end. And if it would end, it would be a great sign if someone could call someone soft on crime and not get elected because of it.
Yeah, no, I don't expect we'll see politicians campaigning on soft on crime anytime soon. But what we have seen is politicians and interest group leaders saying things like smart on crime or right on crime. And this is often where we see actually political conservatives and political liberals both agreeing it makes sense to be smart on crime. And what that means is sometimes different to different individuals, but often that's bringing in the exact things we've been talking about. What is the most cost-effective way to prevent crime? Or what does the research say about what sentence length does for deterring crime? And so I agree. I don't think we're going to see a clamoring toward the phrase soft on crime, but I think there's a good chance we'll see more and more political leaders and interest group organizations talking about the importance of being smart on crime.
One of the things that developed over the last decade or so is something, or two things, well, something called the prison industrial complex and the privatization of prisons, which kind of go hand in hand. What impact did they have on the privatization of prisons and this prison industrial complex have on the expansion of the incarceration rate?
Yeah, great question. The privatization of prisons, this has been increasing. It's still most of those who are in prison in this country today are not in privately run prisons. And so this is still, it's been a growing phenomenon, but it's still most of the prisons in this country, whether state or federal, are government run. But I think it does speak to more of a broader phenomenon of we have in this country declining public trust in government, and increasingly we do see politicians even campaigning against government involvement, right? This is sort of a growing phenomenon, the idea of private business might be able to do things more efficiently, we're told. But what I think we need to remember is we need to look at the research and the data and see, is this really the case? And also, if there's a profit motive, what does that mean is with citizens, when the public envisions criminal justice, of course they want consequences for crimes that have been committed, but oftentimes rehabilitation could be the goal, or for sure when somebody's released, we want them to be successful and productive members of society. And so if it's a privately run facility, that brings in a profit motive. And so that whether that fits with the other goals that we may have in mind is something that really needs to be scrutinized in a careful way. The other thing we often see is, in addition to claims that business might run things more efficiently, is nonprofit organizations. And so I think there's been a growing skepticism of government's role in society, and it will be important to see whether that continues to grow or whether that moves back in the other direction.
That probably will be a debate subject if the issues actually come up in the debates for the presidency, because obviously Trump would lean toward privatizing everything. And I'm not sure what Clinton would do, because she goes back and forth. She really was behind the mass incarceration, which she then has now kind of backed off on. Even one of the things that surprised me is that the African-American vote was so heavily in her favor when President Clinton's NAFTA legislation, which she supported, was one of the ways in which good working class jobs that in which many Black Americans had fled the country. And of course, even when Hillary was found to have called young Black men super predators, it didn't seem to have any effect on the votes of the African Americans, which is kind of bewildering to me. But this whole election season has been kind of bewildering. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, yeah, I think this contrast between Bill Clinton's presidency in the 90s and then Hillary Clinton's campaign now is interesting. And I think that when we return to public opinion and public attitudes toward crime and punishment, and we take the overtime perspective, it helps sort this out, because when Hillary Clinton made those remarks and in relation to the 1994 crime bill, again, that was the height of public punitiveness. So there wasn't a lot of backlash against that at all, because that was right in line with public opinion, and the public had been moving in a more punitive direction for decades. Now, the public's much less punitive than it was. And so this change in what Hillary Clinton's saying and backtracking a little bit and talking about the need for criminal justice reform, I think is right in line with how public opinion's been shifting. So we're still a punitive society and still a punitive public, but it's important to recognize less so than at the time of the 1994 crime bill. And so I think some of these switches are in line with public opinion, and that raises an important question. Do we want political leaders, whether on the left or the right, that dogmatically stick to their positions, or do we want political leaders who are listening to the public and, when public opinion changes, follows the public? And that those are important and difficult questions to think through, especially during a presidential campaign.
I guess people would say it depends what issue you're speaking about, because some people would be one way on for one issue, one way on another. I want to talk to you about the death penalty. What are the feelings been about the American people? What are the changes you have seen, your data show, in feelings about Americans about the death penalty?
Sure. Yeah, the support for the death penalty has also been on the decline, and so there's still some polls show a majority of the public still in favor of the death penalty. But I think if we're trying to understand public opinion, and if we're trying to understand whether policies are going to change or what political leaders are going to do, we need to look at how public opinion's changing. And public support for the death penalty has been declining since the 90s. And some of it is how the media reports on the death penalty. So you mentioned earlier these reports of individuals on death row who have been exonerated, found innocent, other reports of individuals who have been executed, who the evidence later shows were innocent. And so as these imperfections in the system have become more apparent, and as media have offered the public a broader, more nuanced depiction, support has declined. And so it's been an ongoing decline in support for the death penalty, and I think we're going to see that decline continue. So less and less support of the death penalty.
Well, Peter K. Enns, and I should say your initial K is important, because this is another Peter Enns who writes on different subjects, but your book, Incarceration Nation, How the United States Became the Most Punitive Democracy in the World, has a picture of Statue of Liberty behind bars on the cover. It's a thin book, but packed with information, published by Cambridge University Press. You could go to your local bookstores and ask for that, ask them to order it. You could also do it online, but we want to keep our local bookstores thriving. We have a number of them in the county. So, Peter, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World, and thank you for your good work on this subject.
Thank you, Jeff. I really enjoyed having a chance to talk about all of these issues.
They're very important, and thank you again. Thanks for being our guest today on Takes on the World. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.